Their conversation would disturb her husband, but it was not his right to tell her that. He stepped up to the bed and looked at Gasparini. The pale liquid still dripped into the back of his hand. Brunetti nodded to the woman and went out to the nurse's desk and asked for Dottor Stampini, hoping that the doctor had learned something from the CAT scan. They told him the doctor had already left. Choosing to believe this, Brunetti decided to go home, too. Chapter 12. He entered a silent apartment, but years of experience told him it was not empty. The scent of pine forests filled the hallway, which meant that Ruffy had used Brunetti's shampoo again, and in the living room Chiara's red wool scarf trailed down the back of the sofa. "Guido Brunetti, super detective," he complimented himself as he went down the hall to Paola's study. He stuck his head inside the door and found her lolling in complete abandon on the sofa, a book propped on her chest, a pencil in one hand. "Hard at work, I see," he said, coming into the room. He walked over and bent to kiss her forehead.
"Just like you. So busy you couldn't call and tell me about the man who was found," she said in fake umbrage.
He sat at the other end of the sofa and pulled her feet onto his lap.
"How did you find out about that?"
"I wondered why you'd left so early, so I looked at Il Gazzettino online and found the story this afternoon."
She let the book fall open on her chest.
"That could mean only one thing."
Her tone lightened as she went on.
"I also wondered if you'd take time for lunch and whether you were dressed warmly enough. Those silly things wives think about."
He took her left foot and began to push her toes back and forth.
"I didn't want to wake you."
She smiled and admitted,
"It's not easy, I know."
She closed the book and leaned aside to place it on the table.
"Tell me,"
she said.
"Remember I told you about the woman who came to talk to me a week ago, afraid that her son was using drugs?"
He had not told her who it was, only the inconclusive story of a woman who lacked the courage to trust the police and left without giving any detailed information. She nodded.
"It was a colleague of yours, Professoressa Crosera. The man in the hospital is her husband. It looks as though he was attacked on the street."
Paola pulled her foot free from him and sat up in the sofa, facing him, legs pulled beneath her.
"Elisa's husband? I can't believe it. He's an accountant, for God's sake."
She paused for a moment, as if suddenly conscious of what she'd just said, and added,
"I mean, he's such an ordinary man. No one would want to harm him."
A reason could always be found to want to harm some other person, Brunetti knew.
"There are signs that someone grabbed his arm and shoved him down the steps of the bridge. What did Il Gazzettino say?"
"Only that a man was found unconscious on the street," Paola answered. "There was no mention of an attack, only that people were asked to call the police if they saw anything that might be related to the incident, which they said took place near Capesaro. They didn't even give his initials, the way they do when they don't want to provide a name."
Brunetti did not understand the ways of Il Gazzettino and thus remained silent.
"Is Elisa with him?" Paola asked.
"Yes. I recognized him and called her this morning. She's still there, I think."
"Ah, the poor woman," Paola said. "First the son and now this."
"Did you know about the son?"
Brunetti asked, careful to keep his voice neutral. Paola looked up at him sharply.
"Of course not. She'd never tell me something like that. I simply assumed it because she was worried enough to go and talk to you. That means she knew something."
"But she said she didn't," Brunetti insisted.
"Of course she'd deny it. You're the police."
Paola might as well have been reading the multiplication table, so certain was she of her conclusion.
Brunetti decided to leave that remark alone and said instead, "She said she wanted to talk to her husband before telling me anything else."
"When will she be able to?" Paola asked.
Brunetti looked at the back of his hands, then at her, wondering how to tell her.
"Maybe never," he finally said.
When he saw Paola's reaction to this, he temporized.
"That's what the neurologist said after he'd seen the X-rays. He said he needed a CAT scan to be certain. They did that today."
"The results?" she asked.
"I don't know. When I went back to the hospital, the doctor had already left. I can call him tomorrow."
He allowed her to assimilate this, then added,
"He said there was a chance he might be wrong."
Paola nodded. She turned and put her head back on the pillow, extended her legs, and prodded at his thigh with her feet.
"Poor woman,"
she said again. Then, after some time,
"Poor everyone."
She closed her eyes, opened them for a time to study the ceiling, and then closed them again. Brunetti rested his right hand, quiet, on her feet, and closed his own eyes. Soon he felt his reality begin to loosen and drift off from him. He remained seated, but he was somewhere else, and there were people passing by. He felt something move in his hand, and he jerked up, suddenly awake but uncertain where he was.
"What's wrong?" Paola asked. "Nothing. I must have fallen asleep. It's been a long day."
He closed his eyes and leaned his head against the back of the sofa.
"I've been thinking," Paola said.
Brunetti was awake enough to say,
"Always dangerous."
Together, their voices finished this family mantra, "especially in a woman." That done, he asked,
"Thinking what?"
"Legal things. But you've probably already thought about them."
"Tell me," Brunetti said,
aware that he had not given much legal thought to Gasparini's situation.
"If he doesn't die, but just lies there for the rest of his life, what can the attacker ever be charged with?"
Before Brunetti could begin to answer, she added,
"I know, I know. You have to find him first. But when you do, what crime has he committed?"
Brunetti gave this some thought, testing the idea of assault.
"That will depend on what happened on the bridge."
"And in the absence of witnesses, how will that be decided?"
He heard the skepticism in her voice. Eyes still closed, Brunetti nodded.
"You're right, of course. If we get a match for the DNA, that person could very well say he was attacked by Gasparini."
He considered this and then added,
"We have to find him first."
"He'd have to explain why he didn't report it to the police,"
Paola added.
"If he knew Gasparini was injured, he'd have to report it, wouldn't he?"
"Yes, but some people probably wouldn't. At least if it's a minor thing, even if they're the victim. Imagine someone coming to us after attacking another person, even in self-defense. The idea is ridiculous."
He thought about this, then said, voice rich in the surprise with which one announces a discovery,
"No one trusts us."
"Then you must place your hopes in Il Gazzettino and La Nuova,"
Paola said, forcing a note of religious piety into her voice. The thought of it drove Brunetti to ask,
"Would you like a glass of wine?"
With the wine, Brunetti brought his copy of Sophocles, decided on Antigone, and settled in at Paola's feet to read the time away until dinner. He read half of the introduction, written by a professor of psychology at the University of Cagliari. In it, the author presented a Jungian interpretation of the play, with Antigone as an archetype of the mother and Creon of the trickster. One's darker side, the shadow, Brunetti learned, could be exterior or interior. It could be your enemy, or it could be yourself.
Brunetti cheated and looked to see how many more pages of the introduction remained to him. 14. He set the book face down on the table in front of the sofa and took a sip of wine. A very nice Collavini Ribolla Gialla he'd been saving for a special book, and sighed at the different sensations life could offer. Fortified, he picked up the book and flipped past the rest of the introduction and began reading the play. He recalled the opening scene, Antigone explaining to her sister Ismene that the king, Creon, had forbidden that funeral rites be performed for their brother, Polynices, whom Creon had declared a traitor to Thebes. His putrefying body lies outside the city walls, subject to the appetites of vultures and jackals. Antigone has decided that he must be buried, and that she will do it. She asks her sister if she will help her, and Ismene, poor, cautious Ismene, will have none of it. The law is strong. We must submit to the law in this, and even in things that are worse.
I don't think so, Brunetti said aloud.
Paola prodded his thigh with her left foot.
What?
A Jungian psychologist has informed me that one's dark shadow can be either interior or exterior, and now Ismene is telling me we must submit to the law.
I hope there are other options,
she said, not bothering to look up from her own book.
No. And now Ismene tells me that we are mere women, and we cannot fight against men.
This time Paola lowered her book and looked at him. Smiling, she said,
So I've always believed,
and raised the book again. But then, before he could continue reading, Paola said from behind the book,
If memory serves, Ismene is about to protest, I have no strength to break laws that are made for the public good.
Brunetti took one hand off his book and patted her ankle.
That's why they're classics, dear.
She did not choose to dignify his remark with a response. He read on and soon came to that fatal declaration from Antigone, I am doing only what I must do. It might as well have been Professoressa Crosera speaking, doing what she had to do, choosing to obey the law she accepted that gave mothers the right to do anything to protect their children. Seek information from the police, and solace from the fact that her son could not be arrested, and to hell with anyone else's child. Antigone was obeying her own law. He turned the page and found her words. But I will bury him, and if I must die because of it, I say that this crime is sacred. His hand sank to his lap, and he sat, book abandoned, and tried to think of what it would be so to value your sense of what is right, or whatever you chose to call it, as to perform a ritual you believe to be necessary, knowing that your death was the inescapable result of doing so. Brunetti believed he would die for a person, his children, his wife, but for an ideal, a rule? His thoughts turned to Gasparini, that other father. What might he have been capable of doing in order to protect his son? Brunetti considered that possibility for a time. Could it be that he'd got it backwards, and Gasparini had been the aggressor on the bridge? Brunetti chided himself. Only now did he consider the possibility, as if the man's injuries made him necessarily a victim, or because, having spoken to his wife, Brunetti would not think it gentlemanly to suspect him.
"Oh, by the way," Paola interrupted him, "there was a note for you in the mailbox."
"Where is it?"
"On the kitchen counter. I thought you'd see it there."
"No, I didn't," Brunetti said, getting to his feet.
In the kitchen he found an envelope with his name printed on it in block letters. No stamp. It stood braced against the peppermill. He slipped his thumb under the tab and opened it. Inside, written in the same hand, he read, Gianluca Fornari, Castello, 2712. Chapter 13.
The next morning Brunetti arrived at the Questura at 9. When he was told that Commissario Grifoni had not yet arrived, he went to her office and left a note on her desk, asking her to call him when she could. On the steps he met Alvise, who told him that Vianello had come in briefly but had had to return to Marghera again because the wife in the domestic violence case was now volunteering information about her husband's activities in Venice. Brunetti was disappointed that his friend and sounding board would be gone again, taking with him the experience and good sense with which he listened to Brunetti's descriptions of events. There was no need, however, for Alvise to know this, especially when the officer was trying to be helpful.
"Good you told me, Alvise," Brunetti said.
"He told me you'd say that, sir," Alvise answered with a smile, pleased to be the bearer of what he thought was important information. "He asked me to tell you he went back because it's related to the break-in at Signor Bordoni's."
"Thank you, Alvise," Brunetti said in a warmer voice, recognizing the name but not sure why.
He climbed the stairs, sounding out the rhythm of the syllables with his steps.
Bordoni, Bordoni.
On the third sounding of the name it clicked into place, and Brunetti remembered the robbery 3 years before, when thieves had opened the Porta Blindata to the Bordoni's apartment by spraying liquid nitrogen on the hinges and bolts and shattering them, then lowering the metal-frame door to the ground, a job that suggested the participation of at least two people. The family was on holiday in Sardinia at the time, the live-in maid out for the evening to play burraco with her friends, as she did, Brunetti recalled, every Tuesday. The maid had come home at 11, and, finding the door lying on the floor in front of the apartment, had dialed 113 and gone downstairs to seek refuge with the neighbors until the police arrived. When the officers entered the apartment, they found the place in complete order, nothing damaged, nothing thrown carelessly to the floor, the lights on, just as the maid had left them. Everything seemed fine, and the police had begun to wonder why the door had been removed to no purpose, Brunetti remembered reading this in their report, until they entered the study of Dottor Bordoni. Three paintings, which the maid, who had memorized them from years of dusting, described as a fat woman with no clothes on, another woman in a black dress with a black servant holding a red umbrella for her, and a third female, this one perhaps a girl but not looking like a real human being, were gone. It was only on the family's return the following day that Brunetti, who had been given the case by Patta because he knew about paintings, learned that the female portraits were by Renoir, Van Dyck, and Picasso. Everything else was correctly in place. The three paintings were gone, evaporated from among the other paintings in whose company they had lived for years. No attempt was made by their thieves to contact the owner, nor were the paintings ever mentioned by those who occasionally sold information to the art fraud police. And now Vianello, called to assist with an interrogation in a case of domestic abuse, might have caught a glimpse of them. Or so Brunetti hoped. He stopped at Signorina Elettra's office, but as he entered he remembered it was Tuesday, which meant she would have had one of the pilots take her on a police launch to the Rialto Market to buy flowers. He wrote Fornari's name and address on a piece of paper, added a question mark, sealed it inside an envelope, and laid it on the keys of her computer. When he reached his office, he dialed Professoressa Crosera's home phone and let it ring until he was told to leave a message and he'd be called in good course. He told her his name and gave his number and said that he would like to... But before he could finish speaking, the line suddenly clicked open. He hoped it would be the Professoressa answering and waited expectantly for her voice, but the line went dead. He dialed the central number for the hospital and asked to speak to Dr. Stampini in Neurologia, and, when asked, gave his name and said it was police business, volunteering nothing more than that. Dr. Stampini was soon on the line.
"Good morning, Commissario,"
he said, and then went on without the formality of an introduction. I'd like to be able to give you better news than I can, but the CAT scan is fairly clear. He paused, and in a far less impersonal voice asked, Do you understand the jargon?
To some degree, Brunetti answered.
The major damage is to the parietal bone, which was fractured during his fall, perhaps when he hit the railing, perhaps when he hit the pavement. This created a subdural hematoma, and until the brain absorbs the blood, his condition won't change.
Brunetti didn't know whether the doctor expected him to question this. He decided not to.
Have you spoken to his wife? He asked instead.
Yes, I have.
And?
She hears the words and understands the phrases, but doesn't want to understand the significance or the possible consequences of what I've told her.
When Brunetti did not comment, the doctor said,
I suppose you're familiar with this kind of response, Commissario.
Yes, unfortunately.
Stampini's voice slowed and grew warmer.
Have you spoken to her?
No, dottore. I've left a message. I hope she's gone home.
Stampini said instantly, I think she's still here. She told me this morning that she'd spoken with her sister and sent the children to stay with her.
When it seemed the doctor had finished, Brunetti asked,
Has anyone come to the hospital to see her?
Not that I know of.
What do you suggest, dottore?
I think it would help if someone would come and take her home. She has to get some rest, or go somewhere where she can be with people she knows. There's no sense in her staying here.
Before Brunetti could speak, the doctor went on.
The only thing she's told me is that you were very kind to her.
This surprised Brunetti, who had no memory of being anything but firm.
Is there some message you're giving me, dottore?
Stampini laughed or sighed. Brunetti couldn't tell.
Yes, I suppose I am. I think you might be able to persuade her to go home for a while. He's not going to wake up, the doctor said, but quickly added, not for a long time. She should go home, or go to her sister and be with her children. Something. But get away from here.
Brunetti thought about what he might do. Finally he said,
Will you be there much longer?
All morning, at least until noon,
the doctor said, trying to sound professional, but then he added,
She's a good woman, Commissario.
I'll be there soon, Brunetti said, and hung up.
He dialed Grifoni's telefonino, and, not bothering to ask where she was, told her he was at the Questura, but going back to the hospital. For a moment he thought of asking her to meet him there. Woman to woman, it might be easier somehow to persuade Professoressa Crosera to leave the hospital. As he gave more thought to what he had seen of her, however, he decided she would not like the intrusion of another person. Thus he limited himself to telling Grifoni that he'd been given the name of the man who worked in front of the Albertini and had passed it to Signorina Elettra. He added that he'd be back at the Questura as soon as he could, broke the connection, and left to return to the hospital. Brunetti went directly to Neurologia, where he found a different nurse who told him that visiting hours did not begin until 3. When he said he was a police official, coming to talk to Signor Gasparini's wife, her demeanor changed, although not by much. Almost grudgingly, she said he could enter the ward. He went down the corridor and knocked lightly on the door to Gasparini's room. There was no response, so he opened it and put his head inside. Gasparini was exactly as he had left him. From the door, Brunetti saw his wife's back and head, the top half of her body lying on the bed perpendicular to her husband, the rest seated in the chair where Brunetti had last seen her. Her right hand held her husband's left, and she was asleep, the top of her head just touching his left hip.
Brunetti stepped back into the corridor, closed the door and knocked far more loudly, waited, knocked again. Within moments the door was pulled open and she was there, looking startled and angry and not bothering to hide either. She pushed past him and out into the corridor, pulling the door closed.
"What's wrong with you?"
she demanded, voice ragged with exhaustion.
"Do you want to wake him up?"
Brunetti took another step backwards, but said nothing, wanting her question to reverberate in her mind. Finally, when her face told him she understood what she had just said, he answered,
"That would be a good thing, Signora."
He spoke in an entirely normal voice, making it clear that he meant what he said. This was enough to wipe all expression from her face, as though she'd taken a step backwards, only to find nothing under her foot. She banged against the door, making far more noise than Brunetti had by knocking.
"I've come to take you home, Signora."
Before she could protest, he said,
"Dottor Stampini told me your children are with your sister. Let me take you home, have something to eat, and have your children come home, too. And then you can think about what to do."
"There's nothing I can do,"
she blurted out, trying to make her voice steely but failing on the last word. Her face grew flaccid with despair and then tightened in fear. Brunetti, knowing there was no comfort he could give her, said,
"You can cook something for your children to show them you're all right and life is normal."
Before she could protest about the word, Brunetti said,
"That's what they need, Signora. Their father is sick and in the hospital, but they need things to continue as close to how they were as you can make them."
When he saw her prepare to speak, he kept talking.
"They might be teenagers, but they're still children."
He stopped after that and watched as she considered his advice. She raised one hand but let it fall again, then gave a dispirited shrug and said,
"Perhaps."
She turned and went into the room, leaving the door open for him. Gasparini was the same, save that the circles under his eyes were darker today, especially on the left side. Professoressa Crosera walked to the side of the bed, leaned over her husband, and pulled the covers up, although the room was hot enough to make Brunetti uncomfortable. She placed her hand lightly on her husband's cheek, as though it was morning at home and she was going to let him sleep a bit more while she made them some coffee, or went out to get the morning paper so he could read it in bed, the way he liked to. She picked up her coat and bag and walked over to Brunetti.
"Quick, before I change my mind," she said,
and walked out the door and down the corridor. Outside, Brunetti discovered that the sun had decided to flirt with them. There were patches of light on the pavement of the campo, and he reached automatically to unbutton his coat. Brunetti turned right and started over the bridge.
"Where do you live?" he asked.
"Near San Stai," she said.
Then,
"I'd like to walk."
She was looking ahead, so she didn't see him nod. It didn't matter. There was only one way to go. At the Ponte dei Giocattoli, she said,
"Remember the toy store?"
Indeed, Brunetti did. His children discovered it early on and never walked past it without insisting that they go in just to have a look. Gone now, like the rest of the toy stores. Tourist junk instead. Useless toys for bigger children, all made in China, masquerading as Venetian.
"My kids loved it," Brunetti said.
"Mine too."
At the newly transformed Ballerine, he didn't bother to ask her, but went in and up to the bar.
"What would you like?" he asked.
"A macchiatone and a brioche, please," she answered.
Then, as if coming out of a dream, she added,
"And a glass of water."
He ordered, and their coffee and the brioche were soon on the bar, along with a glass of water,
which she drank first and thirstily. She sipped at her coffee, but ate the brioche quickly, hungrily. Brunetti paid, and they left. During the brief time they had been in the bar, the calle had filled up until it was as crowded as it once was, only at Christmas. The crowds shoved them together until Brunetti jutted out his elbow, clearing enough space to allow him to move away from her. Up the bridge, down, and now along the front of the Fondaco, where the lines of Chinese tourists had started their daily ritual visit to their new god, a 21st-century shopping mall. Brunetti drew his spirit tight and turned towards the Grand Canal, then left along the Riva, not having to lead her. The Rialto Bridge stood to their right, and they went over it like people on an escalator, locked in by those moving in front of and behind them, unable to stop, unable to move faster than the slowest person near them, unable to pause lest they be trampled by the people behind. At the bottom she grabbed at his arm and pulled him to the right.
"Get me out of this, please," she said.
Brunetti took 10 fast steps straight ahead, and then cut right and into the campo in front of the Church of San Giacomo. He stopped, facing the bit of the canal they could see through the break in the buildings. She started to walk towards the water, and he came along beside her. She walked all the way to the waterside and looked across at the rear facade of what had once been the post office. She stopped 2 meters from the Grand Canal.
"I can't help looking at it as a Venetian and not an architect," she said.
"Do you like what they did?" Brunetti asked.
He'd been inside and seen the shops, had gone up to the terrace and viewed the city as he had seldom seen it before, a circle of beauty, all of it excessive, all of it perfect.
"I don't like the result," she said, "but some of the restoration is very well done."
"What don't you like?"
Brunetti asked, using his question as a means to bring her back to normality, but also interested in what she had to say.
"Because it's just an expensive variant of the places near San Marco that sell cheap masks and glass made in China."
Brunetti remained silent. He agreed with her, but he was curious about her reasons.
"What do you see that's the same?"
"There's nothing for Venetians to buy in either place. Olive oil that costs 15 euros a half liter, 700 euro boots, a coffee that costs twice what most bars charge."
Before Brunetti could comment, she went on.
"And as far as the other places go, what Venetian wants a glass elephant or a plastic mask?"
He'd heard her use the arguments he'd heard so many times, given so many times, and remarked,
"Paola often asks, where can I buy a zip?"
She turned her head to him quickly, something close to shock on her face.
"Does Paola sew?"
Brunetti smiled at the question.
"Good heavens, no. She uses it as a metonym for what residents need and buy, rather than what tourists buy. Zips, underwear, potato peelers."
He stopped, and, like a car giving one last backfire, added,
"Bread."
She took a step back from him and studied his face.
"What's wrong?"
Brunetti asked, hoping he hadn't somehow offended her.
"A policeman who uses the word metonym," she said, shaking her head. "No wonder Paola married you."
She turned and started walking towards the market. Because it was not the weekend, they managed to pass through it with relative ease. Brunetti noticed many empty places where formerly had stood fruit and vegetable stalls. Half the fishmongers were gone. Out of the market and along the water, then into Calle dei Botteri and 2 more bridges, and then she pulled her keys out of her bag and opened the street door. She closed it after Brunetti, started up the steps and stopped on the top floor, the 4th. Professoressa Crosera opened the door to the apartment, and he followed her inside.
She led him through a small vestibule into a large living room with two comfortable sofas and a view back towards the market, and far off, the campanile of San Francesco della Vigna. She removed her coat and tossed it over the back of the sofa, then went around and sat at the far end. He saw four black-and-white photographs on the wall behind the larger sofa, each showing what appeared to be hundreds, perhaps thousands, of small circular blobs arranged in parallel straight lines. Curious, he stepped closer and saw that they were, as he'd thought, part of the Salgado series of photos of gold mines. He forgot where, perhaps South America somewhere. He stepped back from them and looked at Professoressa Crosera. She had locked her hands between her knees and was leaning forward and staring at the floor. She pushed herself upright and against the back of the sofa and looked in his direction. Suddenly nervous and uncomfortable, Brunetti went and got her bag, which she had set down beside the door and placed it beside her.
"Perhaps it would help if you called your sister, Signora, and let her know you've come home," he said,
and walked over to the farthest window, studying the buildings and towers in the distance. Behind him he heard her begin to talk. Even though she kept her voice low, he could still understand what she said. Brunetti noticed that the window to his right was really a door to a small terrace. He opened it and stepped outside, pulling the door closed. Her voice disappeared. To his right he could see the Campanile di San Marco, squashed between two clouds, that some trick of perspective made look like two large pillows offering to prop it up. He swept his eyes farther to the right and began playing one of his oldest games, "Which church is that?" Because he was alone, he couldn't verify his guesses, but the tilted tower was easy to recognize as Santo Stefano's. Brunetti turned just as she put her phone back in her bag and looked in his direction. He went inside and approached her. Somehow her sister had managed to calm her. That was evident from her face.
"Signora, sooner or later we'll begin a formal investigation of what happened to your husband."
"What will that achieve?" she asked.
"For your husband, very little, I'm afraid," he said, unwilling to be an ally to her self-deception.
Then, more firmly,
"I'd like to be able to find the person who did this."
"I'm not sure that will help anything," she said. "Or anyone."
"It might stop the person from doing it again," Brunetti offered.
"Would I sound cruel if I said that's not of much importance to my husband, nor to me?"
She smiled. One of the saddest things Brunetti had seen in his life.
"Not cruel, Signora. Not by any means. But I'm asking you to make the decision, not your husband."
"What decision?"
she asked, honestly surprised.
"To let us ask you questions and ask questions of your friends," he said, not daring to mention her son. "Is there anything you or they think might be related to what was done to your husband?"
"I told you about the trouble with my son," she said.
"Yes," Brunetti agreed. "Was there anything else that was troubling your husband?"
She thought about this for what seemed to Brunetti a long time and finally answered,
"Growing old.
Whether his company would survive the economic crisis, global warming, his paunch, what our daughter and her boyfriend did together."
He smiled, and she asked,
"Did I say something funny?"
"It was like looking in a mirror and seeing what I worry about all the time," he answered. "And I'd add having a boss who dislikes me at times," Brunetti said.
"Anything else?"
she asked dispassionately, rejecting his offer of a more relaxed atmosphere.
"About what I'd like to do as part of the investigation?"
"Yes."
"I'd like to take a look through his belongings, his study, if he has one," he said, continuing to avoid reference to her son.
She nodded at this, but Brunetti didn't know if it meant her husband had a study, or she would agree to let him look through it. Or perhaps she was merely acknowledging that she understood his request. Hoping that it was the second, he said, "I'd like to do it now." Sensing her reluctance, he thought it might be time to play the trump card of her son's safety. Few mothers could resist the power of that appeal. She looked at her watch, but before she could speak, they heard the front door open and then a heavy thud as it was pushed back against the wall. Surprise catapulted her from her chair, and Brunetti wheeled around to face whatever was coming. Two teenagers came quickly into the room, a boy and a girl of almost the same height, though the boy's face showed that he was younger than his sister. He wore jeans that hung loosely on his hips, a brown leather jacket, and a pair of almost new Stan Smiths. The bottom part of his head had been shaved to the height of his eyebrows, and the rest left long, to create a strange two-tiered effect. He had his mother's dark eyes, and although his body was very thin, his face was still surrounded by the puppy fat of childhood. His jaw had yet to take on the angularity of adolescence. He stopped short when he saw Brunetti. His eyes shot to his mother, back to Brunetti, back to his mother, showing that this was an uncommon configuration.
"Who's he?"
he demanded. His face was tight and his lips pulled back from his teeth in a primal declaration of menace. The girl turned to him in surprise, disapproval written on a face that was a younger version of her mother's.
"Sandro,"
she said, voice tight and filled with reproach. The boy looked at her, obviously unable to decide between outrage or contrition.
"All I did was ask who he was,"
he said to his sister, his voice wilting in the echo of her reprimand. Brunetti smiled at them and said, "I'm Guido Brunetti. Your mother asked me to accompany her back from the hospital." He turned to the professoressa and said in casual farewell, "If there's anything else I can do, call Paola, please." Then, speaking to both children, he added, "That's my wife. She and your mother are colleagues at the university." He took a few steps towards the door, and, when abreast of them, paused and said, "Your mother's been at the hospital with your father all this time, and hasn't had anything to eat. I think it would be good if you'd take care of her. Perhaps you could help her make lunch?"
"What's wrong with him?"
the boy asked in a strained voice. Instead of answering, Brunetti turned back to the boy's mother, who told them,
"The doctor said you could both visit Papa tomorrow. Until then, I'm the only person they'll let see him."
The boy started to speak, but his voice failed to find words and turned into a light moan. It lasted a few seconds, and then he asked,
"Is he going to die?"
That brought his mother to her feet and to his side. Wrapping her arms around him, she said, in a voice Brunetti could hear, struggling to remain calm and hoped the boy could not,
"Don't be silly, Sandro. He's got two nurses and the best doctor in the hospital. You and Aurelia can come and see him tomorrow."
She turned to Brunetti for confirmation.
"Isn't that right?"
"If Dottor Stampini says it's all right, I'm sure they can."
Brunetti nodded to the woman and took the opportunity to leave. As he reached the door, he heard three sharp, barking sobs, but a sense of decency stopped him from turning to see which one of them it was. Chapter 14. As he let himself out of the building, Brunetti felt that the day had decided not to throw in its lot with winter quite yet, and had returned to early autumn. By the time he reached Campo San Cassiano, he was sweating under his jacket. He thought about taking off his coat, but when he recalled the route he'd have to take to get home for lunch, all in the shade,
He merely unbuttoned it and pulled it open for a moment. He turned to face the sun, feeling rather like a late-season sunflower trying to beat the odds. Had the sun been an old friend, packing and preparing for a 3-month vacation, Brunetti would have told him he'd miss him and wish him a good time down there in Argentina and New Zealand, spending the winter months wisely by the sea and staying warm. When he turned into Ruga Vecchia San Giovanni, he was proven right and rebuttoned his coat for the rest of the walk home. Brunetti couldn't shake himself free of the thought of Gianluca Fornari. He pulled out his phone and dialed Signorina Elettra's number while climbing the first flight of stairs.
"Good morning, Commissario,"
she said pleasantly, as though a call from him was what she'd been waiting for since she arrived in the office. Before he could ask, she said,
"Signor Fornari has been known to us for some time, since he was 18, as a matter of fact."
Brunetti was about to say he was surprised that a man well known to them would have restrained himself until he was an adult, when she continued, saying,
"He has a file with the juvenile office, but I didn't want to go looking around in there so soon after making inquiries about Alessandro Gasparini."
Ah, she was calling it making inquiries now, was she? Brunetti threw that thought to the ground and pinned it there with his foot while he asked, "And the file he has with us?"
"He's spent 11 of the last 20 years as a guest of the state,"
she answered, gave a little grunt, as though stretching to retrieve something just at the end of arm's reach, then said,
"Ah, here it is. 5 years for a series of robberies in Mestre and Marghera. He was in prison from when he was 20 until he was 25, and then 3 more. From when he was 29 until he was 32, for selling drugs to minors in Padova."
Brunetti heard a page turning.
"He was 34 when he went in again. Same crime, selling drugs. But he was released 1.5 years ago."
"And since then?"
"I can't find any record of employment. There's no sign he's paid taxes in those years."
As was common with most people today, the way she said this suggested approval, though with Signorina Elettra, Brunetti was never certain what her sentiments were. He reflected on what she must have done in order to get that information, and he marveled. She could get in, even there.
"Has he been in any trouble with us since then?"
he asked calmly.
"Nothing. I called the Vigili Urbani to ask if they'd had any contact with him. A few of them remembered him from years ago, but no one could recall having had anything to do with him, even seeing him for a long time."
After a moment she added,
"One of them said he's married, and said the wife is a good woman. No children."
"And now he's selling drugs to the kids at the Albertini?"
It did not occur to Brunetti to question the information Manrico had given him.
"I've no idea, dottore," she said. "I'll see what else I can find."
He was about to end the call when she added,
"I checked their phone records, and there were no calls between him and Gasparini."
Arriving at the landing in front of the door to his apartment, he thanked her for the information she'd found.
"I'll be in about 3.
He added, said goodbye, and broke the connection. He put the phone in one pocket, took his keys from another, and let himself in. He did a human radar scan of the house and concluded that no one was home. It was then that he remembered. The chairman of Paola's department had requested her, begged was the word she'd used when telling him why she wouldn't be home, to sit in on an interview with one of the people who had applied for a teaching position. Rafi was playing basketball, and Chiara's art history class was being shown the restoration laboratory at the Accademia Museum. Paola would no doubt be invited to an expensive lunch in return for her time. The kids would have fun, while he had no choice but to search for leftovers in the refrigerator and eat alone, with only the newspaper for company, unless Paola had taken that with her to read during the interview.
"Oh, you do whine, don't you, just?" he asked himself aloud.
He went into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator, where he found a saucepan, and on the shelf below a dish covered with aluminum foil. He pulled them out, placed them on the countertop, and took the lid from the pan. Cream of celery root soup. The other had a note on top. "You don't have to heat them." Peeling back the foil, he saw what looked like veal meatballs wrapped in speck. Turning on the oven, he stuck the plate inside, then put the pan on the stove and turned the flame to medium. He pulled down a bowl and took a glass from the cabinet. Leaving the soup to heat, he went back to the bedroom and picked up his copy of Antigone, which he had left face down last night. Back in the kitchen, he pinned it flat with a serving spoon and a small plate from the drying rack. He found another spoon and stirred the soup, then licked the spoon to test how hot it was. He sliced some bread, looked in the refrigerator again, and quelled his disappointment at not finding a salad. He stirred the soup, filled a glass from the tap, not because of Chiara's sensibilities, but because he was too lazy to open a bottle of mineral water, and sat at the table. He found his place and looked for the scene where he had left off the previous night. His eye fell on something he had underlined decades ago when he read the play at school. As he recalled, it was something Ismene had said. Ismene, ever wise, ever cautious, ever subservient. There it was, with his own decades-old, fading, faint underlining. "I must obey the ones in power." He glanced away, trying to imagine what he, an 18-year-old boy, had understood of power and its uses. He smelled something burning and ignored it, thinking that his imagination had caught the scent of the funeral pyre on which the body of Eteocles, the loyal brother, had been burned with full honors, his traitorous brother's body abandoned to scavengers. That smell again. He turned aside and saw the steam rising from the saucepan. "Oh, Dio," he muttered, jumped to his feet and grabbed at the handle. He pulled the pan off the flame and set it on the marble counter, hoping it was not burned irredeemably. He found a soup bowl and poured it out, then tipped the pan a bit to the side, the better to see down to the bottom. It looked all right, so he stirred the rest around a few times, added it to his bowl, and carried it to his place. He took a sip of water and set the glass to the right of the bowl and went back to his reading while he waited for the soup to cool. Creon now, prating away in that voice so favored by powerful men. How they loved to hear themselves use it, and they probably loved to hear it in those they judged to be their equals. Simple thoughts, simple ideas, simple commands. "See that you never side with the people who disobey my orders," the king commands, and the leader of the chorus falls over himself in his haste to agree. Never, only a fool would be so much in love with death. After the sentry reports the crude attempt at burial, Creon unleashes the ultimate weapon of the bully, sarcasm. "When were the gods last seen helping traitors?" Brunetti took a receipt from Rosa Salva from his pocket and slipped it into the page and closed the book. Knowing that to continue to read would cause him to pay no attention to his lunch, he pushed the book to the other side of the table and began to eat. He wished only that Paola had left him that day's Gazzettino, for its ham-fisted, factual accounts of death and misery could in no way trouble him to the degree that Sophocles' world of invention and fancy did. When he returned to the Questura, he asked about Vianello, but there had been neither sight nor sound of the inspector. Grifoni had come in at 1, but had gone out for lunch and was not yet back. As he went up the stairs to his office, he tried to think of what he would do if he wanted to sell drugs to students, but did not want to risk arrest. He did his best thinking at the window, So he went and studied the facade of the Church of San Lorenzo and considered the possibilities. Fornari could have one of the students do the selling for him, but this would not change his legal liability, might even worsen it should the student be apprehended. And he'd have to share the profit. Hardly a wise decision. The important thing would be to limit, or better, eliminate direct contact between himself and his customers. So long as he did not actually put the drugs into the hands of a minor, there was no serious crime involved. Therefore, he'd have to find a place to leave the drugs, and a reliable person would see to the sale. Once the students knew where the drugs were available, they had only to go there, hand over their money, and get them. Not entirely whimsically, Brunetti asked himself if, in 10 years, drugs would be delivered by drone. He remembered a friend of his mother, insatiably curious about the doings of her neighbors, and a gossip of majestic proportions. Whenever his mother saw her go by, she would tell her son that the woman was on her way to curiosare, one of his mother's uses of language. If only she'd had the advantage of schooling beyond the 4th grade, what might she have done? He'd never told anyone, not even Paola, how much he missed her still. He had no clear idea of the situation or arrangement that might make the sale of drugs invisible. Thus, there was nothing for it other than to go over to the Albertini and curiosare. He heard someone knock at his door and called out, "Avanti!" Vianello came in and closed the door after him. The grin on his face remained there as he approached Brunetti's desk and took one of the chairs in front of it. Brunetti walked back to his desk and sat. Vianello said nothing.
"All right, Lorenzo," Brunetti finally declared. "You can stop grinning now and tell me what happened."
The inspector slumped down in the chair and stretched his legs out in front of him. He crossed his ankles and observed the tops of his shoes.
"Are you going to sit there and preen, or are you going to tell me?" Brunetti asked in false exasperation.
Vianello's grin disappeared.
"I got there before they were ready to begin the interrogation this morning. Pastore, the man I was working with, said he wanted to show me some of the things they found in the thief's apartment when he was arrested."
Brunetti shifted in his chair and folded his arms across his chest.
"All right, all right," Vianello said, quite amiably.
He took an envelope from his inside pocket and placed it on the desk in front of Brunetti.
"Have a look."
He pointed to the envelope with conscious melodrama. Brunetti lifted the flap and saw some sheets of paper. He pulled them out, unfolded all three, and spread them flat in a row on the desk in front of him. He saw color photocopies of what looked like photos of 3 paintings, all portraits of women. In the first, a black servant held a red umbrella over the subject's head. In the second, the woman had eyes of different sizes, and the third showed a very robust, naked woman bending forward to wipe her feet with a towel.
"Bordoni,"
Brunetti said, recognizing them instantly.
"The guys they were questioning had these? In his apartment?"
"Yes."
Brunetti wrapped the back of his fingers against the 3 sheets of paper in turn and asked,
"Did he have these photocopies of the paintings or the paintings themselves?"
"Only the photocopies," Vianello answered.
"And the paintings?"
Vianello shook his head.
"There were a lot of things in his apartment, but no paintings."
"What did they find?"
"There were photos of other paintings. He also had a number of watches, jewelry, some Renaissance brasses, a small Roman statue of a goddess, an Isnik tile, and about $12,000. In dollars."
"Any of this reported missing?"
"They found the owners of the tile and 4 of the watches.
They're looking through their records to see if any of the other things have been reported stolen.
Brunetti considered what his friend had told him.
So he's a professional. It would seem so.
The fact that he has photocopies.